Dr. Greenstein is going to speak. Just two technical things. His presentation will be from this screen, which I believe everybody in the room should be able to see. Also, just another technical point from the parking. There is a car with a Connecticut license plate 605SSU, which is blocking one of the entrances to Lot E. Again, Connecticut license plate 605SSU. If that person could bring their keys to Lot E, that would be greatly appreciated. Dr. Greenstein.
Thank you, Eddie. All right, well, first of all, yasher koach to all the organizers. This is a wonderful, wonderful symposium that you have put together. And to have almost, if not more than 400 people here, to hear about organ donation and about the gift of life is a wonderful thing. Secondly, to follow Dina Raskas, it's a great opening act to follow because she really brought forth all the points that needed to be considered about transplantation and what it does. The problems of kidney failure, clearly she brought in. And then the final aspect of getting a living donor from the community. And that's probably the biggest thing that's going on right now. Now, I'm the warm-up to Rabbi Willick, and I'm going to be speaking about the medical aspects of live transplantation. Although 2 days a year I do get smicha in the sense of before Tisha B'Av and before Yom Kippur, I always get called by all my Orthodox patients about whether or not they can be fasting or not. And so 2 days a year, I become a rabbi. But all the rest of the time, I'm just a plain old doctor. So with that, let's talk about transplantation. Those are not my slides. That's Eddie's slides. As Eddie mentioned, the problem of transplantation is that there are so many people waiting for organ transplants. Do you have the control or I have the control? You have the control, right? Okay, next slide, please. Okay, well, back one. I'm sorry. So today there are more than, and I'm going to be talking about kidney live donation, the medical aspects, because I'm trying to stay not controversial, and there's some people who would tell you that liver transplantation is a little bit more controversial because the risks are greater. And since we want to start with simple things in terms of halacha, it would be easier to talk about kidney transplantation from a live donation point of view. So today there are more than 65,000 patients who are currently waiting for a kidney transplant in the United States. Now I can tell you 15 years ago that list was much less. There were maybe 10,000 or 15,000 patients waiting. It's grown tremendously. Part of that growth is the fact that we recognize we can transplant people very, very safely today. 25 years ago, diabetics were not transplanted. Today, 25% of all patients waiting for a transplant are diabetics. And it goes on to other diseases. 25 years ago, you would not transplant somebody more than 60 years of age. Today, the oldest person I've transplanted is 79 years of age when I did him 3 years ago, so now he's 82. And he actually got a live donor transplant from his daughter. So all these things, we've grown tremendously. And with that, though, we have now more than 65,000 waiting for a kidney in the United States. Approximately 8% of these patients will die waiting for an organ. So what are the solutions that we have for this very complex problem? Two potential solutions, or actually three. One is for somebody who has kidney failure to stay on dialysis. And as Adina said, it's not that great. There are lots of problems associated with that. But there are patients who should stay on dialysis and should not get a transplant. The other solution is to get a transplant. Inside of getting a transplant, there are two solutions. You can either get a deceased donor. In the olden days, we used to call it cadaver donor. And because it wasn't proper in terms of how to speak about people, we now call them deceased donors. I'm not going to be talking about that. You will have discussions later on about the halakhic issues about deceased donation. What the other way of getting a transplant is a live donor transplant. Next slide. What you have to realize, transplantation as a field is not that old. The first living transplant was done December 25th, 1954. It was done on Christmas Day in Boston. And in those days, they had to go through really major hurdles to do these transplants. They had to determine that these two brothers were truly identical. And I found out recently that the way they did this, because they didn't have the genetic testing that we have today, is they went to the ultimate, they went to fingerprinting. And the two brothers had the exact same fingerprints. So they knew they were truly identical. So transplantation is only, as you can see, 52 years old. Today, nearly 50% of all the transplants, kidney transplants that are done in the United States are from live donors, whether live living related or live unrelated donors. So who can be a live donor? You have to be more than 18 years of age. Why? Because if you're less than 18 years of age, you have to go through the court system. And if it's a really smart court, they should not give consent for that child to donate his or her organ, because they shouldn't give consent. They should wait till the child is of age to give his own consent. Then, what else can you have to know about the live donor? The live donor should not have diabetes. It's not an absolute contraindication, but it is a relative contraindication. What do I mean by that? If you have somebody who's 40 years of age, markedly overweight, always eating at Kosher King or whatever it's called now here in YU, and has diabetes because of overweight, if they lose that weight and now they're not diabetic anymore, theoretically they can give a kidney. Theoretically. They can't have kidney disease. Why? Because the basic rule for kidney donation is do no harm. You don't want to do any harm to that live donor. And if they already have kidney disease, what are you taking a kidney from them for? They already have kidney disease. They're going to need one possibly. You don't want to take a live donor kidney if that person has lung disease. COPD is what we call it. Because the operation can be very difficult on somebody who's got bad lung disease. And you don't want to take a kidney from a live donor if they have significant cardiovascular disease, heart disease. You don't want to take from somebody who's markedly overweight. I don't mean overweight like myself or Eddie, just a little bit overweight. I mean markedly overweight. Because it's a major operation. And again, do no harm. You have to make sure the donor is HIV, AIDS negative, and also hepatitis negative. Because the worst thing you can do is transmit a new disease to the recipient. It can be a relative. It can be a spouse, living unrelated. And in terms of that, one of the most beautiful stories I heard when I did this transplant about 8 years ago, husband gave to his wife the kidney. The husband said, I asked him, why do you want to do this? He said, because 25 years ago, she gave me her heart when we got married, and now I'm giving her my kidney back. You get these really beautiful love stories. And that's what transplant is all about. It's all about love stories, whether it's a live kidney or a deceased donor. So in the olden days, we used to have emotional ties between the live donor and the recipient. Today, it's not as critical. And there are people in this audience who are living unrelated donors, who have my yarmulke goes off to them that they were able to do this, because they really believe in the process of helping their fellow man. And that's what it's all about. It's the true gemilas chesed. Next slide. Again, more specifics from a medical aspect. Okay. You have to be blood type compatible. When you hear about transplantation, you hear, okay, you have to be compatible. What does that really mean? The first thing is you have to be blood type compatible. An O kidney can go into anybody or into an O. An A kidney can only go into an A recipient. A B can only go into a B. An AB, they won the lottery. They can get anybody's. By the way, parenthetically, I have found more AB blood types in the Hasidic world than in any other ethnic group. I don't know why, but that's what I've been finding lately. You have to be cross-match compatible. Essentially, you take some blood from the donor, blood from the recipient, mix it together, and you see if they have a war inside of that test tube. If there's no war, if they survive, then they're compatible. Then you get into the third thing. Do they wear the same genes? Are they Calvin Klein genes, Sassoon, whatever genes you want to talk about? But that's not important, what genes they wear. It's just they have to be blood type compatible, tissue type compatible. Once you get past those first two steps, you have a shidduch. You can do a transplant. But what you have to realize, federal law, and this is very, very important in the United States, because more and more, Eddie will be seeing those ads in the Jewish press, Hamodia, I need a transplant, please call me. What you have to realize, federal law makes it illegal to buy an organ in the United States. So if I know that you're buying an organ, I won't do the transplant. In fact, nobody will do the transplant because I don't want to go to federal prison. And that's what you have to realize. You cannot buy an organ in the United States. You want to buy an organ, you go to a third world country, India, China. But as you know, you get what you pay for. When you go to someplace else, you may not get really what you're getting, what you want to get. I have somebody who's coming to me in 5 weeks, went from Israel to South America for a second transplant. Now she's going for a third transplant, but she's coming to me. So realize that. You don't want to go and buy an organ. It's not really the best thing you can do, even if you do it outside of the United States. All conversations between the donor and the transplant team, because you have to realize the donor is not really a patient in the true sense, does not have to have this operation, is doing this out of the goodness of their heart. So all of those aspects of the donation have to be kept confidential. And the results of that medical testing are kept confidential, especially nowadays because of HIPAA laws, which I love to violate, but don't tell people that. But the bottom line is you cannot disclose somebody's personal records to somebody else. So you don't tell the recipient anything. It's the donor's obligation to decide whether or not they want to give their kidney to the living recipient. The cost of the living donor evaluation, because everything has costs related to it, all the costs related to the evaluation, the testing, and the surgery are generally paid for by the recipient's insurance. So you don't have to worry about it. If you decide tomorrow, you call me up and say, I love what you said. I really want to help somebody else. You don't have to worry about it if you have only student loans, because it's not going to affect you because it's not going to be on your insurance. It's going to be in somebody else's insurance. Next slide. So to go through the evaluation, what do? You have to have a complete history and physical, and that means everything. And a psychosocial evaluation. We have to make sure you're not a little bit loose up there. There are no loose screws. Because you're only going to have one kidney. I want to make sure that you will have that kidney for the rest of your life and that you're not going to play funny games. Routine lab tests, CBCs, creatinine, things like that. We test to determine compatibility, as mentioned earlier. You test to determine that you have two kidneys. Because clearly, if you only have one kidney, you can't give that kidney. And then the final test on the downside is the test to determine what the railroad tracks are like, what the anatomy is to those two kidneys. And from that, I determine which kidney we take, and from that, we determine how it's done. Next slide. Why should you be a living donor? What are the advantages? Better matching. If you're going to be looking at Calvin Klein's and genes like that, a living donor usually has better match, especially a relative, a son, a brother, a mother, father, things like that. So you usually, with better matching, better results. But in 2006, given the drugs that we have, the results are pretty good, even if you are a no match. As long as you're compatible, it's usually very, very good results. And the other thing is that the kidney begins working right away. So that patient has to deal with the halakha question, do they say asher yatzar, right away, given that they have a folion. I'll let the rabbis deal with that question, though. The other thing is that the transplant can then be planned. You can plan it so that's not going to be done in Rosh Hashanah, because they won't do it in Rosh Hashanah. You have better preparation for the donor recipient. The recipient is in optimal condition. The donor, because he's giving a fresh kidney to the recipient usually has also a shorter hospital stay. And because it's usually better matched, the recipient takes less medicines over the life of that kidney. There's a tremendous psychological lift, a true love story that goes on between donor and recipient. You hear about these altruistic donations where the anonymous donations where the donor and recipient don't know each other. I don't believe in that. I really believe that they should get to know each other because it's unbelievable the energy that's transformed and transferred from each donor to recipient about what goes on. Next slide. Disadvantages. Well, there's no free lunch, and that's the most important thing I can tell you. There is no free lunch even with live donation. There are downsides. A healthy person has to have a major operation, and therefore there are risks to the donor. I'll tell you about that in a minute or so. And on the recipient side, there are risks because nothing's guaranteed. There is always the possibility of a failure of the transplant. And I tell this to every recipient when I meet them, no backseas. The donor cannot get that kidney back if you should blow it out. If you lose it, it doesn't go back to the donor. It's destroyed. So in terms of the donation, the medical aspect, if you want to call that, about how the operation is done, there are two ways it can be done. Either open, more pain, versus laparoscopic, less pain. Either you have a big incision about with my fingers, or you have multiple incisions, about 3 to 4 incisions with a little bigger incision to take the kidney out, about yay big, 2 inches big. Which way it's done depends upon the anatomy of the kidney in terms of which kidney you're taking out. That's how we do it at Montefiore, and that's what we believe in, because we believe that the most important thing is that you want to make sure not only the donor does well, but that the product that comes out, that kidney, is a good product, and that it goes into the recipient and works. The decision about which way the kidney is taken out is done by the transplant team. And again, it's based upon anatomical reasons. Difference in donor pain and length of stay not only is due to the donor operation, but it's also due to who we are. You know, men have not had major operations, at least most men, so we don't know what pain is. So we usually fetch a lot more than women do who've given birth to babies. So what can I tell you? That's really what you have to realize about donation in terms of pain. In terms of the short term, for the donor, it's a 2 to 3 hospital day stay. If they had done on Wednesday, a live donor, they're home before Shabbos on Friday. And in terms of how long it takes to go back to work, 2 to 6 weeks. Depends if it's a live donor open nephrectomy versus laparoscopic. Laparoscopic has less pain. They're back to work usually within 10 to 14 days. All the medical bills, again, are related to the donation covered by the recipient's insurance. Major surgical complications are less than 2%. 3 out of 10,000 die from this operation, 0.03%. And why do they die? Given that we carefully screen them, and I can tell we've never had anybody die at Montefiore. They die, and you hear about this in the country. They had one donor death recently in Israel this past 6 months. They die for multiple reasons. Cardiac events, things happen. They can have bleeding problems where they bleed out, you know, a tie falls off, something like that. So you can have these really weird things happen, but when it happens to that person, it's 100% first of all, and it's lethal. And when it happens, it's horrible for the whole transplant team, for the recipient, for everybody. It's a horrible event when that happens. Next slide. What about the long-term risk? There's no physical risk to donation for the living donor. Who knows risk better than anybody? Businessmen, life insurance companies, because they deal with risk all the time. Your life insurance premium does not go up because you've given a kidney as a live donor. And if they don't increase your risk, they're telling you that there really is no increased risk, that you should live out a normal, healthy life, even with one kidney. What you should also realize, there are many people walking around, probably people in this room, who only have one kidney and don't know it. The first time many people find out is when they go into the military and they go for the physical. That's when they find out, or something like that. So there are people walking around with only one kidney. There is no harm to the remaining kidney. Now, that doesn't mean you can just go and become a skydiver, a bungee jump. You shouldn't do crazy things like that, because you only got one kidney out to live on. But you can live out a normal life, and if you're a woman, you can go on to have more children. I'll give you an example. About 12 years ago, I did this Hasidic mother, Satmir mother from upstate. She gave to her son, her oldest son, a kidney. A year later, she brought me cakes for the Shalom Zachar after she gave birth again to another child. I mean, so the point I'm trying to make is that childbearing is not an issue for a woman if they want to donate. Next slide. What about, though, when something does go awry? Donors who do need a transplant. Of more than 75,000 live donor transplants that have been done since 1987, only 119 have been listed with UNOS. That's the United Network for Organ Sharing, the organization that Eddie went on the website last night and this morning. And these 119 needed a deceased donor. It's not that very common. But all you have to be is that one person to be 100%. So realize that. It's not a free lunch. Those patients who've given kidneys as a live donor, now who need a kidney, get extra points. They go to the, they get allocation priority to go to the top of the waiting list. So on the positive side, if I'm ever going to need a kidney, I get this extra point so that I'll get a kidney faster. Next slide. What about survival rate? Because clearly, you take out the kidney, you want to make sure it does well on the recipient side. If it's not going to do well, why do it? Live donor-related transplants, 1 year graft survival. That means 1 year later, 100 people today, 1 year later, how many of those kidneys are working? Not patients, but kidneys. 95% of those kidneys are working when it's a live kidney. The patients, nearly 100% of the patients are alive 1 year later. All right? Very, very good results. In contrast, the graft survival rate for a cadaver, a deceased donor kidney, is about 10 to 15% less than a live kidney. So you have to realize there is a slight difference. But that difference between a live and a deceased donor kidney is shrinking with the medications that we're having brought to the market each year. Next slide. So there's no significant difference. This is very important when you're talking about living unrelated. There's no significant difference between living unrelated and a living related at 1 year and at 5 years for these grafts. So here you have somebody who wants to give to somebody off the street. That's a living unrelated, no relation, no blood relationship. That has no difference than between two brothers. So the genetic matching that I mentioned about the genes earlier on is not that critical anymore. You just have to be compatible. Next slide. Now, what's gone on over the last couple of years, in contrast to 15 years ago, where living life transplantation was unheard of in my mind in the Orthodox circles. It really was. Contrast that to now for the past 5 years, where you see ads like this. This was one of my patients put an ad in the Jewish press, this is about 5 years ago, saying that he needed a transplant. Two people, husband and wife, answered. Turned out the husband learned with this guy every day in shul. They didn't know, he didn't know that this person needed a transplant. All right? And so the husband and wife got tested. The wife gave the kidney, and now he's more than, this is an O2, so it's almost 5 years out that he's done this, had his transplant. These are publicly solicited live donors. And you see it every week now in the Jewish press, Hamodia, and things like that. They develop a bond, and it's a beautiful love story. And I think that's the area where we as a community in the Orthodox circles can grow. There are organizations out there right now that are trying to bring forth more living donors and make the shidduch with recipients in the Orthodox world who need transplants. And that's very, very important because that's where we can still have the growth. Next slide. This is just a slide just to show you the difference between live and cadaver. And you can see the difference in lines. The top two lines are actually the patient survivor rates, and then the bottom two lines would be the graft survivor rates for living versus cadaver. And you can see there's a marked difference between cadaver and living. But these differences are actually only in the first year, actually, because if you look, after the first year, these lines are parallel. Next slide. And with that, I'll finish, and I'll let Rabbi Willick now give the halakha kishus for live donations. Thank you.
I brought with me, just as a prop, one of those ads from the Hamodia. Big print, you can read all the way almost in the back. Newlywed woman, 23 years old, very desperate for kidney. Anyone with blood type ARO, please call with two phone numbers. So what you're hearing about is not just history, it's current events. Reshus Rabbonim, my time is somewhat limited. I'll try to cover the basics of this rather complex topic in as brief a fashion as possible. The most important statistic that Dr. Greenstein mentioned is a very low mortality rate associated with, again, let's focus on kidney transplants for the moment, at the present time. First glance, this would create an imperative for any individual in good health to seek out a recipient in order to fulfill a positive commandment and to avoid the violation of a negative commandment. Vahashevo solo, the Gemara teaches us in Masechta Sanhedrin Daf Ayin Gimel, as a positive commandment, restorative. The rabbis understand that if one is required to restore a lost object, how much more so is one required to restore a possibly lost life? In addition, Torah tells us, Lo samor adam reyecha, a person is not allowed to stand idly by if someone's life is about to be lost. Therefore, for example, the Gemara teaches, a person who sees someone who is drowning must jump into the river to help them. Someone who's being attacked by an animal or by bandits must try to help them. So teaches us the Talmud. Indeed, in a very straightforward responsum, Harav Avadia Yosef Shalita, Yechavedas Chel Gimel Simen Pei Dalid, tells us, seems to tell us, that such an obligation exists. His day was written 20 years ago. The mortality was a little bit higher. He writes then there was more than 99% survived. Now it's 99.97, whatever the percentages are getting higher and higher as we go. But even then, he said at first glance, it should be an actual obligation. He quotes the Radvaz. The Radvaz says, go back to the paradigm. Someone is in danger of drowning in the river or is attacked by wild animals or by bandits. If I attempt to save that person's life, by definition, I am undertaking a risk. All of us know stories, tragic stories, of lifeguards who went to save a patient that were pulled in by the patient. They're rare, but it does happen. If an animal is attacking someone and you try to save the victim, the animal can turn on you and so can the bandit. So by definition, inherent in the process of saving someone, there's a slight sakana, danger. Hence, argues the Radvaz, this is an assumption that the Gemara makes, that one must undertake a small risk. It's not clear how large the risk is. The Me'iri, on that same daf, Sanhedrin Ayin Gimel, says, this obligation exists only if it's below sakana. There's no risk. But that seems to be against the empirical facts. We know there's some risk entailed when you go to, when it's a bandit, there's a wild animal, you're in deep water. So presumably the answer is it has to be a very small risk. I don't know where the cutoff is, but I do feel that the present danger involved in kidney transplant is so low that it would satisfy even the Me'iri's criterion of no risk. Nonetheless, a careful look at the Yechav HaDa'as teaches that he changed the expression. In the Radvaz's cases of plunging into the water or attempting to save the individual from the bandit or the wild animal, he uses the expression chayav, one is obligated, which is, of course, a natural expression. The Torah says, vashevo salo, you're obligated. Lo sama, you're obligated. Nonetheless, the Bavadja's phrase that he uses is mitzvah. We heard before from Mrs. Raskis, one could not imagine a greater mitzvah. That's exactly the word that Rabbi Yosef uses, but there's a difference in halacha, clearly, between mitzvah, which is a laudable, positive commandment which one fulfills, and chiyuv, an obligation. And we don't find in the halachic literature, to my knowledge, anyone who says explicitly that it's an absolute obligation to do so. To give a kidney, for example. And the question, of course, becomes why? Logically, so far, everything we've said, it should be an obligation. As soon as we finish today, I mean, before, right now, we should go to the transplant center, everyone who's of good health, get on the line and find anyone. I believe you're allowed to have directed donations. You can do it to a member of Am Yisrael because you want to fulfill Reyecha. I don't want to get involved in the whole general issue which surrounds that, but one can do so. It's within the law. And why don't we all just run to do it immediately? After all, it's an obligation. So one can potentially argue that after all, there is pain involved, and perhaps one is not obligated to undergo pain in order to save someone else's life. The Mogen Avraham, end of Siman Kuf Lamed Vav, says, no, a person is obligated to suffer pain in order to save someone else's life. The Netziv, in the Shiltas, Kuf Chav Tes, of Cotton Dallas, says exactly the same thing. Each one cites a Talmudic reference to prove his point. However, it's not completely clear whether these proofs are absolutely compelling. In the case of the Mogen Avraham, it's referring to an individual who is required to undergo pain rather than reveal the identity or the whereabouts of someone hiding in the Beis Medrash who's going to be killed by the Romans. Now, there are two alternatives: suffer pain or actively cause someone's death. So there the Mogen Avraham has a proof that you're required to suffer the pain. However, we do not learn from that Gemara that one must actively enter into a situation of pain rather than have someone else die when you're being completely passive. So it's not quite a perfect paradigm for our situation. In the case of the Netziv, bases himself on the Gemara in Sanhedrin of Ayin Gimel, where the Gemara teaches that Lo Sama Lo Dam Reyecha adds to the Hashevosalo, that you require to hire workers to pay money and to undergo tircha, to undergo a bothersome experience in order to fulfill the losam, to avoid the violation of the losam al dam reyecha. And Rashi has an expression. Rashi's expression there is chozer al kol hatzdodim. And the Netziv assumes this means everything, including the suffering pain. However, in a strict construction sense, Rashi is limiting himself to the cases of the Gemara, which mean either spending money or undergoing tircha. Rashi doesn't mention pain explicitly. As a matter of fact, the Rav Yaakov Emden disagrees with the Mogen Avraham. Says one is not required to undergo pain in order to save an individual's life. And the Taz in Yoredeya in Simen Chuf Nun Zayin seems to agree with this position. Nonetheless, modern poskim say that one does not put all different pains in the same situation. How much pain? Pain could be a severe pain, somewhat mild pain. In the Sefer Nishmas Avraham Mikosov Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who was presented by one of his Talmidim with a proof, a case of a woman who is a nursing mother and the child may be in danger if she has to undergo certain pain in order to nurse, and perhaps in certain cases she would be or wouldn't be. And he responds, it all depends on not all pain is created equal. It may depend on how severe the pain is and how long the effects of the pain will last. It's hard to know specifically with respect to kidney transplants whether this obligation would exist upon this criterion. However, even if one assumes that one is required to undergo pain to save a life, and I personally believe that a certain limited amount of pain, one is required to do so, and this is relevant, for example, to bone marrow transplants, which is also involve a measure of pain, which can save lives, which in my opinion, one is obligated to undergo. And I'm proud to say that in my shul, a little tiny shul in Riverdale, we had an individual who saved a life through a bone marrow transplant, met the person dramatically at the Gift for Life dinner in June on the stage for the first time. And that Shabbos, this individual who was a not yet observant shul from England, spent Shabbos in our shul, and I made an introduction in front of the whole shul. It was a beautiful thing. Getting closer to home, I'm happy to say that today's topic is very relevant to my community. Just yesterday, we had a wonderful, beautiful surprise kiddush that was tendered by a member of our community in honor of his wife, who donated a kidney to save his life. Talk about a real love story. This is a wife and a husband. So I feel in my little shul, we have had a connection to this topic that we're discussing. So let us now go to see what the Gedolei HaTorah have said about this particular topic. The classical tshuva is by Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, Yoredeya Chelek Bey, Simen Kuf Ayin Dalet, Anaf Dalet, in which Rav Moshe writes that a person is not required, the words are very carefully chosen, there is no chiyuv, there's no absolute obligation for an individual to donate an organ to save someone else's life. A mitzvah, yes. But as I say, it's very, very important to distinguish in halacha between a mitzvah, a positive commandment is fulfilled, it's laudatory, it's wonderful, but it may not necessarily be mandatory. If it's mandatory, we all have to go do it right away. No questions asked. If it's laudatory, we should be encouraging it, but nonetheless, we don't have an absolute obligation to do so. And Rav Moshe explains, it's based upon a Ramah in Yoredeya Kuf Nun Zayin, where he says a person is required to give all of his money, so he shouldn't be in violation of a lo sase. And based upon the Shach, Rav Moshe says that money, yes, but an organ, not. And it's not the time to go into this strict halachic analysis. Rav Moshe says, well, even though an organ is not considered the equivalent of a full life with respect to Chilul Shabbos, we may not be Mechal Shabbos and Midorais according to Rav Moshe and most authorities to save an organ, as long as the life itself will be intact nonetheless. We can draw a distinction, Rav Moshe says, between positive, I should say, active and passive. That's exactly the distinction I mentioned on my own before, between active and passive to refute some of the earlier proofs. Rav Moshe is exactly the same thing, that perhaps actively we may not do any, we may not violate things for the sake of an organ. We have to be careful in our precise analysis. So the organs might be the equivalent of money when it comes to Chilul Shabbos or doing other Averas Midaraisa. You may not do that. Nevertheless, to say that you are required and obligated to give an organ to save a life, there the organ perhaps is not the equivalent of money. That's Rav Moshe's conclusion. Tzitz Eliezer has a tshuva about it. Chelek Tes Simen Mem Hei. He quotes the Radvaz, who has a distinction almost word for word that Rav Moshe said. Rav Moshe didn't have the Radvaz in front of him. And he adds a phrase, a remarkable phrase. Drachecha darche noam. That means the ways of the Torah are pleasantness. Now theoretically, if there was an obligation, an absolute obligation on an individual to give a kidney to someone who was in desperate need of it, it would be like any other obligation, which Beis Din can enforce. Not today, of course, but when Beis Din had the power. Beis Din can force an individual to wear tefillin and to sit in the sukkah, ksubas daf pei vav. Beis Din can force an individual to give his kidney to save someone else's life. That would be the natural extension of it would be an obligation. This, argues the Radvaz, is not the Rochecha Darchei Noam. It's very nice, it's a big mitzvah for someone to do so. But to say it's an absolute obligation would not be in the category of the Rochecha Darchei Noam. And this would be true, argues the Tzitz Eliezer, even according to those authorities who maintain that an individual is required to place himself in Safek Sakana in order to save an individual from a Vadei Sakana. That is an opinion which the Tzitz Eliezer himself does not accept, or Moshe does not accept, and many Gdolim do not accept it. But even according to that opinion, that's one thing. You take a chance on yourself, you know, even if it's a 50-50 chance, but if you win, you will come out completely intact and whole. Contrast this with a person, we said no backsies, that once if he does it, he cannot get that organ back, and therefore, according to the Tzitz Eliezer, as well as to Rav Moshe, it's not an absolute obligation. As I mentioned before, even Rav Avadya, who has a very powerful presentation, at the bottom line, he takes out the word chiyuv and inserts the word mitzvah. This is something which is very, very important. There is one final word I want to mention just as a last word, and that is we have to be careful when we speak about live organ donations, speaking about kidneys, and again, I'm not going to go into the issue of lungs or liver, which may be on the one hand more dangerous, the liver, some can grow back, that may have an interesting thing, you may end up being intact at the end of the day, but I'm just mentioning that without going into the details, time does not allow it. I just want to mention one final word, which is that there are some individuals who do something sort of in between. It's not quite a live organ donation where the person can hopefully live the donor till 120 years. And it's not quite the case of someone who has passed away and they're doing what they call the cadaveric donation, but it's a donation in which a person, as soon as they die, their organs are removed. They're basically brought into the operating room to die, and the organs are removed immediately. This can lead to, what Dr. Green says, called DCD? DCD. This is something which can have a potentially halachic problem, because sometimes in order to arrange that the death take place at a certain time when the team is there, the team may in fact hasten the death of that patient. That's a very tricky. We must be very careful about that. This has nothing to do with the later issue of brain death. This is I'm staying away from that issue. But this is something which is something which we have to think about very carefully. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thank you very much to all the participants in this wonderful session. We will try and get the question and answer a little later in the day for this session. I apologize about that, because our next session will actually be Rav Schechter speaking via video conference where he is currently in Los Angeles. So we'll take a very brief break while they're setting up for the video conference, and we look forward to seeing you back in just a few moments. Please stay as close to the room as possible. Those of you who need to exit the room, please do so. But literally, because of time constraints, we'll be starting within 5 minutes.